Okay, now we do three half bows to the Buddha. Testing. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Okay, I think it's. Okay, I'll start with homage to the Buddha. Namo tas. Oh, I have my recorder. I forgot to do it. Okay, we'll start with homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato Sama Sambuddhasa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhasa. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Yeah. It would be useful if I could have the original of the page on dependent origination. No, she has the original. Thank you. Okay, there it is. Okay, we've been studying the greater discourse on the destruction of craving. This is the Maha Tanha Sankhya Sutta. And last time I just went through the formula of dependent origination on page 354 to 355, taking it backwards from birth as the condition for aging and death, and then taking it in sequence back to the original condition, which is ignorance as the condition for volitional formations or volitional activities. Okay, then starting with paragraph 19, the Buddha takes it sort of quickly back through forward order. And he starts with what we might call the general principle of conditionality. So he says, when this exists, that comes to be with the arising of this that arises. This is for those who like to study, you know, very deeply. I'll write the formula in Pali on the board. Okay, the formula is actually made up of two parts. There's one part consists of two lines, and the second part consists of two lines. Okay, has anybody here studied Pali? Okay, so. Yeah, this phrase, it's what is called, don't get upset with this, a locative absolute, which means one thing that is existing or going on as a condition for another thing to occur. So, imasmin sati means when this exists, and then literally it's this comes to be, but the two thises represent two different things. So in English we would say this and that. So when this exists, that comes to be. And then this is a statement of, we call in terms of cases, the ablative case. Through the arising of this, this arises. But again, the second this is different, so we would better to translate through the arising of this that arises. So this basically establishes a kind of principle that it's a very broad principle of conditionality that can apply to almost anything. So it doesn't have to be restricted to the 12 factors that we usually find in the formula of dependent origination. But we could say, when the seed is planted, the tree will grow. Through the planting of the seed, the tree arises. Or when there is maybe a housing crisis, unemployment occurs. Through the occurrence of a housing crisis, unemployment arises. So you could apply this general principle of conditionality almost to any phenomenon in the world. So this is the general or universal principle of dependent origination, or we call specific conditionality. Of course, it means not simply that things arise from conditions, but that there are specific conditions for particular phenomena to arise. But the Buddha is not just, though he lays out this general principle of conditionality, but the main focus of his teaching is with the arising and ceasing of dukkha, of suffering. In general, the suffering of the round of birth and death, or samsara. And so he takes this general principle of conditionality and then he applies it. We have the pragmatic or applied principle of dependent origination, which is here laid out in terms of 12 factors. So the way the Buddha elaborates on this general principle of conditionality, with ignorance as condition, the formations or volitional activities come to be. With the volitional activities as condition, the volitional activities are our wholesome and unwholesome actions, the activities that create karma. Then with those activities as condition, accompanied and underlaid by ignorance, there comes the arising of consciousness. That is the first arising of consciousness in the process of conception, embryonic development, and then through the whole course of life, the consciousness is sustained by past volitional activities. Then when consciousness arises, it doesn't occur alone, but consciousness brings into being along with it nama-rupa. This is the mental name and form, which as I explained last week, this is the psychophysical organism excluding consciousness. So form is the physical body, and nama or name are all of the mental activities that occur, or mental functions that occur along with consciousness. Okay, as name and form starts to take shape in the womb, starts to develop, then there emerge out of them the six sense bases. The five physical sense bases emerge out of the developing physical organism. And then as the nama or the mental side develops, then the mind faculty emerges and begins to function. Okay, then the organism, the new organism, is equipped with these six sense bases and then uses these six sense bases to make contact. Contact is what? It's the coming together of consciousness with a sense object through a sense faculty. So contact means that the visual consciousness, or that consciousness meets visible objects through the eye, and then we get eye consciousness, visual consciousness. Consciousness meets sounds through the ear, and then we get ear consciousness, and so on. Okay, so the six sense bases are the base for contact, basis for condition for contact. When contact takes place, then there occurs feeling, pleasant feeling, painful feeling, and the neutral feeling that's neither painful nor pleasant. Okay, now when feeling occurs in an unenlightened mind, an undeveloped mind, the usual response to the feeling is craving. That is, when there is pleasant feeling, there is craving to enjoy the pleasure. When there is painful feeling, there comes a repulsion towards the pain, an aversion towards it, and an attempt to escape from the pain by seeking new sources of pleasure. And then if there is a neutral feeling, sometimes if it's a kind of dull neutral feeling, then one needs some kind of stimulation, and so one again goes seeking new sources of pleasure. But if it's a very subtle, peaceful, neutral feeling, then there comes a kind of attachment to that pleasant feeling, to that neutral feeling. Okay, so out of craving, there arises clinging. So craving is basically the desire to obtain pleasant objects, agreeable conditions that one doesn't yet have. And then what's called upadhana is the holding to those pleasant and agreeable objects and agreeable situations, agreeable conditions that one has already obtained. It's the holding to them, the unwillingness to let go of them. It's kind of driven by a kind of maybe underlying anxiety that our pleasure, our security, our sense of identity depends upon holding to these things that give us enjoyment, that give us some sense of status, position, prestige, power, personal identity in some form. And then through that clinging, we engage in a fresh round of activities. This is what is called existence, bhava, which means the what I call the karmically active side of existence, the karmically creative side of existence, in which we engage in new activities, activities intended to procure pleasure and position and status for ourselves, or to protect and reinforce our satisfactory situation. And sometimes they can be harmful, violent activities, but they can also be wholesome activities. For example, if one, as most people do, at least even most Buddhists do, believe in a pleasant afterlife, in a heavenly world, so then they'll do good, meritorious activities with the hope of being reborn in a heavenly world or having a good status in the human world again. So the karmic activities can be both wholesome and unwholesome, both good and bad, but as long as they are accompanied by ignorance and by craving, they will construct a future mode of being, a future state of existence. And so karmic activities or karmic existence is what creates our future existence. And then our future existence begins with birth, and then it leads from birth into growth, and then from growth there comes aging, decay, and death. Okay, so that is basically the sequence of the 12 conditions. And now when one just looks at the 12 conditions, the way they're laid out in the sutta, it's sometimes difficult to understand, but the commentaries have given us some helpful indications for understanding how these 12 factors should be seen, how we should put these 12 factors together into some kind of meaningful pattern. And they do this by classifying the 12 factors in a number of ways. So I've shown these ways of dividing up the 12 factors on the page that I handed out. So we could take a look at this page. So first, we can see that the 12 factors are divided by way of three periods of time. So there's the past period, which contains ignorance and the sankharas, the volitional activities or formations. Then there's the present period, which spreads out over, is it eight factors, I think? Eight factors from consciousness through the karmically active side of existence. And then there is the future period, which includes birth, aging, and death. Now this way of dividing up the 12 factors should be seen, I use the expression, it should be seen as an expository device. It doesn't mean, as some people think, that, okay, ignorance was something in the past, it doesn't exist now. Consciousness, name and form, and something exists only in the present, they didn't exist in the past. That then the big puzzle, how can birth occur in the future? Doesn't birth occur in, didn't birth occur in the present? Didn't it occur in the past? But as I'm going to show, these 12 factors are actually very intricately interwoven. But when the text used 12 factors, they lay them out in a way that spreads out over three lives. But in actuality, they are interwoven, interacting, interdependent, interconditioning all the time. We'll see how that occurs in a few moments. But first, a few other modes of analysis I want to go through briefly. Okay, now taking this division of the 12 factors into three periods of time, we have three connections between them, or sometimes the three links. Okay, so one link is that between the past causes and the present effects. That is the link between the volitional activities and consciousness. So in this scheme, the volitional activities belong to the previous life, and those volitional activities propel consciousness into the new life. And it's those volitional activities that determine the particular realm of rebirth in which consciousness will arise. They determine the particular conditions under which consciousness will arise. And throughout our life, these volitional activities are constantly rising up from the past, you know, beneath the threshold of awareness and conditioning our consciousness in the present. Okay, so the volitional activities backed by ignorance propel consciousness into the present, into the new life. Then as this new life unfolds, the factors from consciousness through feeling are basically the working out of past conditions, the kind of reflection of past causal conditions. So the arising of consciousness, name and form, is brought about by past karma, and then it's through the inflow of past karma that the six sense bases emerge, and this past karmic activity determines to a great extent our contacts and feelings. So this is occurring through the kind of inflow of past causation. But then, between the feelings that we undergo passively through the contacts that we make, sort of involuntary contacts, between those feelings in our response to them, there is a certain gap or a certain hiatus, a certain opening. And so we are free to react to feeling in different ways. If we apply mindfulness and clear comprehension to the feelings, then we start to weaken the process of causation. We start to dismantle it or disassemble it, sort of deprive the defilements of their potency, their ability to sustain and propel the round of existence on through future cycles. But if we don't have this mindfulness and clear comprehension, then the normal reaction is craving. And so between feeling and craving, there is a certain gap or a link or a connection, and that is called the link of present effects. The present effects culminate in feeling, and then we react to that feeling. That reaction through craving begins a new cycle of causes. So craving is, between feeling and craving, there is the link between present effects and present causes. Okay, the present causes culminate in the volitional activities, so karmic activities, karmic existence. And then this is followed by the next factor, which is birth. And birth is the birth into the future life. It's actually, technically, it's conception into the future life. And so there is a gap or link between the karmic activities or karmic existence and birth. This is the connection or link of present causes with future effects. Okay, so these are the three links or three connections. Okay, then the 12 factors are grouped into three rounds. It's called the three rounds, but it seems to me it's better to call them three divisions of the one round. The one round is the whole round of birth and death. But the three divisions are ways of dividing the 12 factors according to their role. Actually, maybe role is a good way of representing this rather than round, because we take the word role, it also can represent vata is varta. Like, it's probably etymologically connected with the English word whirl. Varta, vortex. Whoops. I just thought of that. It never occurred to me before. But vata, Pali vata, is Sanskrit varta, which is related to vortex or roll in the sense of rolling over. But also this can signify the three roles that these 12 factors can play, in the sense like the role that an actor plays in a movie. So one role is that of defilements. So we look at the 12 factors and we want to see what of these 12 factors are actual kilesas or defilements. And so we look and we can see, starting at the beginning first, ignorance. Ignorance is said to be the most fundamental of all the mental defilements. And we look down, skipping over 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, till we come to craving. Craving is a defilement. And so craving comes, plays the role of a defilement. And then clinging is really a strengthening of craving, a kind of hardening or stiffening of craving. So clinging is a defilement. It plays the role of a defilement. So in the role of defilements, we have ignorance, craving, clinging, factors 1, 8, and 9. Okay, then the next round or role is the round of karma. And so this role of karma is played by the volitional activities. It's actually the volitional activities that create karma. So that plays the role of karma. And then we come down to karmic existence, the karmically active side of existence. So number 10, that karmically active side of existence is the round, belongs to the round of karma. What is the resultant side of existence? That is what begins with birth and leads through growth to aging and death. So number 10 could actually be divided up into two. Factor number 10 actually has two aspects, but the second aspect is covered by birth and aging and death. Okay, so then we've taken out now the defilements, the karma, then everything else begins, it belongs to the round of results, that which is the product of karma. So these are the, from consciousness through feeling, that's 3 to 7, and then birth and aging and death are the results of our previous defilements and karma. Okay, so we have these three different groups. And as I said, these three groups actually form three phases within one, what I would call one round. So that round begins with the defilements, and so it's our defilements that motivate us to engage in various activities. Generally, defilements motivate us to engage in unwholesome activities. But when we engage in wholesome activities, as long as the defilements are present, those wholesome activities will create more karma. It will be good karma, wholesome karma, but still it belongs to the round of birth and death. So we go from the round of defilements to the round of karma. Then the round of karma is what brings the results or the fruits of karma. And so that includes these, all these other factors. Then what generally happens on the basis of these results, once there's consciousness, name and form, for the five aggregates together, then based on that, there will take place another, more defilements will arise, followed by more karmic activity, followed by still another existence. And so any existence can really be represented by the five aggregates of bodily form, feeling, perception, volitional activities, and consciousness. And then these five aggregates stem from past ignorance, craving, and karmic activities, and they serve as the basis for more ignorance, craving, and karmic activities. So if I were to try to complete this little blackboard formula, I'd have to go back forever and ever and ever. But we just have to draw a stop to it someplace. Okay, so when we look at the 12 factors, then we see that there are what we call two roots of the round. One root in this 12-fold formula is ignorance, which is considered the root that goes from the past and extends into the present. And then there is craving, which is considered the root that exists in the present and extends into the future. So those are the two roots. Okay, at this point I'll ask whether there's any questions. Before I come to the little complicated matter of the 20 modes and four groups,
What's the difference between craving and clinging?
Basically, clinging is pretty much what I call an intensification of craving. That's one way to look at it. Oh, I see you were looking for that. Or else one could look at craving as the desire to obtain what one doesn't yet possess, and clinging as the holding or grasping to what one has already acquired. The commentary of works like Visuddhimagga, they use a simile. Craving is like the thief extending his hand to take maybe an object from a store. Maybe a thief is stealing a piece of cake from a bakery. And the clinging, it's the holding on to the cake and taking it back home with him.
So, is covetousness and possessiveness, are they equivalent terms?
Well, it depends on what the Pali words would be. Maybe covetousness is somewhat like craving, and possessiveness like clinging.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you break down tanha and upadana?
Upadana.
Upadana.
Into the way they're analyzed in the text?
It's a breakdown of really how they're translated.
Oh, I see. Etymologically.
Yeah.
Okay. This is actually...
That helps a lot, actually.
Yeah, that could be helpful. Okay, the word that's translated as craving in Pali, it's tanha. Rescued it. Yeah, the word tanha is related, actually, to the English word thirst. And we can see this more clearly, perhaps, from the Sanskrit form, which is trishna. So there's another Pali form, not so common, but it occurs occasionally in the text. Also, it's related to this tasina. So you can see that maybe the original sense is thirsting for something that one doesn't. Like when somebody is thirsty, it means they don't yet have water. But there is an intense yearning or wishing for water to quench the thirst. The word upadana actually based on the root da.
Is that upa plus a plus da? It's just hard for me to read that, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Is that on the right when you have you?
Yeah.
That is, yeah.
Is this with one?
No, I can see it now, thank you.
Is that, I think it's a, can it, people on that side see?
Yes.
Okay. So the word da means to give, like we have the word dana, giving, generosity. But when it has the prefix ah, it changes the meaning from to give to take. And then upa is a strengthening word, and it has more the sense of towards oneself. So upadana is taking up upon oneself. an upadana, it's sometimes used for the fuel of a fire, because the fire is seen as something which takes up the fuel in burning it. And the commentaries sometimes explain upadana means another. Explain it, they use the expression dalha gahana, which means, dalha means firm or tight, and gahana is translated grasping, and it's related actually etymologically to the English word grasping. We could see it more clearly again in the Sanskrit. We have graha. Yeah, it's just the same except that there's an R, but that the R makes the connection with the English grasping clearer. So it's tightly grasping, or tightly holding.
Thank you. That makes it clearer.
Yeah. Okay, any other questions?
Father, I just have a clarification. You mentioned that defilement motivates us to engage in unwholesome activities.
Yeah.
But we can also engage in wholesome activities that would create good karma.
Yeah.
That would still keep us within the realm of birth and death.
Not all. There are good activities, of course, that lead to the liberation from the round. But say, when people have sometimes like a desire for rebirth and happy realms, good realms, then they engage in good activities, and that those good activities create the karma, which, if it's really strong enough, it will bring them into the good states of existence. And so, I mean, temporarily, tentatively, we have to aim to create good karma in order to have the prospect for a good state of rebirth and to avoid falling into the unfortunate states of rebirth. But still, as long as there's that desire or craving to go on, then the good activities keep us in bondage. Please go.
So, really, as far as practice is.
Maybe take the.
I was just looking, I know I've looked at these a million times, but again, once again, revisiting the 12 things. So, it seems like.
Yeah, now it's on now.
Hello?
Yes.
In terms of practice, it seems like the contact and the feeling comes up automatically. So the practice is between the feeling where you have that, where you're talking about the response.
Yeah.
To the craving.
Yeah.
The practice is in that whole little area right there.
Yeah.
Regardless of what you bring from the past.
Yeah.
Forward.
Yeah. I'm going to deal with that aspect after I finish the, what I call the forward movement.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay, somebody asked on the internet, if a tree falls in the forest and no one is around to hear it, does it still make a sound? Contact needs the minimum of three factors, the object, the faculty, and consciousness. When there's no contact, there's no sound. I don't know, I would say that when the tree falls in the forest, there is a sound, but there's no hearing of the sound. The object is there, but there's no awareness of that, the object, which is the sound. Then the second question, can we think of ignorance as the centripetal force that retains the self-delusion of the conscious force, which is constantly grasping and clinging? It's a good metaphor. Centripetal, I think, means pulling in, is that correct? Centrifugal is going out. Yes, centrifuge is what sends things out. Okay, it's a good metaphor. Any further questions? Okay, now then I want to go into it's the third column on the table. This is called the 20 modes in four groups. And this is very useful because it shows how the 12 factors are actually constant. It shows how the 12 factors are actually interwoven. Why is it making that noise? Okay. It shows how the 12 factors are actually interwoven so that the scheme of the 12 factors is actually something of an abstraction. Okay, so now if we look at the 20 modes, that column, we see that, okay, when there's ignorance, is that coming from this one?
You're getting feedback from here. There's a feedback, yeah.
Maybe because the two of them are on simultaneously?
Yes, there's feedback.
All the metal object needs to be away from me.
Are there too much on? No. Too many metal. Yeah, there's not metal. There's a feedback loop. Okay, let us try. I didn't have this problem before. Suddenly it started. Did you turn off the other one?
It is off.
Just speak with my natural voice?
No, just speak to it, into it.
Okay. Okay, let it.
Yeah.
This is better. Okay. Okay, so these 20 modes show us how the 12 factors are interwoven and actually integrated with one another, with each other. So looking in the first section under the third column, First, we see that when ignorance is present, ignorance, along with ignorance, there'll be craving and clinging. So we don't really have a situation where ignorance belongs to the past and craving and clinging belong only to the present. But in any life in the past, when there was ignorance, along with that ignorance, there was craving and clinging. Then what we call the volitional activities, number two, and what's called karmic existence, are really just two different names for the same thing. Maybe they have a slight difference in nuance, but they're pretty much indicating the same process, the activities that create karma. And so when there is, in the past, when there are volitional activities, those volitional activities are creating the karma that will build up a new existence. So we have 10 present. So in the past, there were these 5 causes. And in the present, of course, we have these 5 effects, 3 to 7. And I just want to say a little something about contact and feeling being considered as effects. We shouldn't think that this means that all feeling and all contacts are effects. Since there are many types of contacts that I seek out through my present will, and these can give rise to pleasant feelings. So these, for example, maybe I like to watch wrestling matches. Just say somebody who has that kind of temperament, not myself. But kind of person who likes to watch wrestling and boxing, violent sports. So that person has a kind of craving for that excitement of violent activity, and that will bring the contact with boxing matches, wrestling matches, violent sports, and then that will bring the kind of feelings of excitement, joy when his favorite fighter is beating the other fighter, and so that will bring pleasant feelings, and disappointment, grief, sorrow if his chosen favorite fighter is losing, or if I like, you know, particular type of music, then I will go to the concert to hear that music, and so I seek out this contact when I hear the music. Then it will give rise to pleasant feeling. So these are feelings, or if I hear certain news that somebody that I like has met with some misfortune, then I will feel sorrow over that. Or if somebody that I like has met with some good luck, some success, then I'll feel joy and happiness because of that. Then these are the feelings that are arising through my present volitional activity. These are not coming about through the results of the past. But a lot of the feelings that we undergo come about sort of passively because we're making encounters with things that we don't have, with situations over which we have no control. And then these are bringing up certain feelings in us. So a certain number of feelings are the direct effects of past karma, but not all feelings. Okay, so anyway, for convenience sake, the factors from consciousness through feeling are considered the present effects of the past causes. So those are the 5 present effects. Then we have the present causes, craving, clinging, and karmic existence. But whenever there's craving and clinging, along with them there's ignorance.
So we have ignorance in the present too, implicit in craving and clinging. And when we mention karmic existence, that is virtually synonymous with volitional activities. And so we have five present causes: the craving, the clinging, the ignorance, and the karmic existence and volitional activities. And these present causes bring as their future effects birth and old age and death. But birth, old age, within birth, old age, and death, we get consciousness, name and form, six sense bases, contact and feeling. And so we actually have five future effects. And so in this way we have five causes in the past which bring about five present effects, and five causes in the present which bring about five future effects. In fact, in the future effects, you could have put in birth, aging, and death, then you could have had seven future effects. But I think the authors of this treatise, they wanted to make it very neat, just keeping everything reduced to fives. And so they kept birth, aging, and death out, and just kept consciousness through feeling as the future effects. Okay, so this takes care of the entire table on dependent origination. And it shows, again, how everything, all of these factors are intricately interdependent, interwoven, so that it's only through an abstraction that we can draw out certain factors and say these belong to the past, these to the present, these to the future. Okay, any questions now about the 20 modes and the four groups?
Pandit, I have a question. For the case of Arahant, I'm pretty sure it's number 1, 2, 8, 9 is eradicated. But for the above, number 10?
Okay, for the Arahant, number 1, 2, 8, 9 are eradicated. And number 10, you're asking?
Yeah.
Does that remain for the Arahant?
That's remain, and then for one more life?
No, because the Arahant doesn't have a future life.
No, I mean, it's present life.
Of course he has present activities, but those activities are not constructing another existence. And so they wouldn't be considered number 10. Number 10 are karmic activities, are activities considered only insofar as they are creating the karma which will bring about a new existence. In fact, the Arhat doesn't even create karma that will bring its result in this existence. His actions are considered just bare activities, but not karmically creative activities. Please.
That's because there's no, I'm always mispronouncing this, upadana.
Yeah,
is not, doesn't grasp onto,
yeah.
So there's no
bhava.
There's nothing to...
Yeah, there's no ignorance, no craving, no clinging.
To come into existence.
Yeah. Well, this is another... Okay. Can we describe consciousness as a grasping, clinging life force or life energy? And Gandhava is just a special term for consciousness. At first, I don't think it's correct to describe consciousness as necessarily a grasping or clinging force, because grasping or clinging can be eliminated, but consciousness will remain. This is in the case of the arhat who has consciousness but no grasping or clinging. Then the gandhapa we will come to later. It's in the same sutta, but I won't take it today. Next week we'll take the gandhapa. Any further questions here? Dina?
I fear to ask.
No, you never should be afraid.
Fear to ask. Where
I only bite one who has a silly question three times.
And I'm not that smart.
I only have a tiger in a cage. A hungry tiger.
And he's waiting for me, I think. Perhaps I'm grasping.
But go ahead, don't be afraid.
We'll
order up some steaks for him from the butcher.
Does the concept of heaven and hell occur here somewhere?
In the Buddhist text? Or
around all of this, there's no mention of that.
In this formula, it's not mentioned, but they're mentioned in other texts. Yeah.
Does it have impact on this or no?
Well, those would be some of the realms in which birth can take place.
But we're not going to consider those realms now with this.
I don't want to go into the different realms now. Yeah.
Okay.
I think this link makes sense to me, except the one that I'm struggling with is the one from ignorance to volitional activities.
Yeah.
And the reason is because, under volitional activities, it could be wholesome.
Yeah.
So I can see how unwholesome would cause the rest of
the things
to come into being. But wholesome, I guess, as long as, like you said before, there's a desire, a craving, and clinging, it's going to bring about the rest of the factors. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of maybe an interesting case. Okay, let us take somebody who is maybe we call like an atheist in the sense of not believing in any kind of future life. But this person, it's also a good person, so it's a generous person who gives to humanitarian projects, very kind, generous, helpful to others. Okay, but this person still has like an underlying ignorance and craving. It doesn't mean that it's always like a bad kind of craving, like a craving for wealth or power or position. But just that there's still those factors underlying the mind. And so these good, wholesome activities still have the capacity to produce a rebirth, even though he doesn't believe in the rebirth. But from our understanding, they create that karmic force, and that karmic force will lead to a rebirth, maybe in a heavenly world or a happy human state of existence.
Oh, wow. It's heavenly.
Well, I wasn't going to discuss them at length. I'm just using this as an example. So it's the underlying ignorance in the sense, you know, not the gross ignorance, like we say, he's a bigoted, ignorant, deluded person. But this is just the kind of not having that penetrating insight into the real nature of the real like laws of the universe.
So it's more like our latent tendencies?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good expression. The latent tendencies or underlying tendencies. And so when the karmic when the activity is there, creating the karma, then it will bring the consciousness to a different realm. Yeah. What is your name? I just forgot your name. Did you have a question?
I have a quick question. I'm interested in the word sati, because it was used here, it seemed, in connection with existence. And not knowing any Pali, I heard it to refer to mindfulness or awareness.
No, this is a completely different word. when I had the formula on the board before? Yeah, that was not, it's not the word sati meaning mindfulness. This was a, it's the present possible form of the verb ati, to be.
Okay, I have one question. I also wondered, where does the consciousness store in our body, or where is it?
You asked that question last time, too.
Yeah, I thought I heard that.
Question.
Yeah,
last class, last book we were studying, he asked the same question.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway, the early suttas, they don't speak about a place, a physical place, where consciousness is stored or where consciousness is based on. And even the early Abhidhamma texts just speak about that physical form on the basis of which consciousness arises, but it doesn't specify what that physical form is. But the general Buddhist tradition locates the base, the physical base for consciousness, is what they call the heart base, which it's not the actual physical heart itself, but it's supposed to be some kind of like a subtle kind of form around the area of the heart. And that is considered the base of consciousness.
The heart chakra?
It would probably correspond to the heart chakra. So not the brain. In fact, I agree with this tradition. From my own sort of investigations. And the way I sort of understand it, I use a comparison with a computer. I mean, this is a little bit off the topic of the sutta, but with a computer, the central processing unit is like the brain. So all of the programs that utilize the, draw upon the computer, all the programs, and all of the processing of information takes place in the central processing unit. But the power that drives the computer isn't coming from the central processing unit, but it depends upon another source, which will be the source of the electricity, either from the power grid, if it's plugged into the wall, or from the battery, if it's running on battery. But once that power of the electricity comes in, then the central processing unit can use that power in order to process information and work and run programs and read files and so on and write the files. So similarly, the way I understand it, the sort of source of consciousness is actually the heart base. But once that consciousness is flowing in through from the heart base, then the brain is what uses that consciousness for whether thinking activity, any type of mental activity. But that's my personal opinion. Don't say that. Don't think that this is orthodox Buddhism anyway. The Buddha. Somebody's going to write a book. The Buddha compared consciousness to the central processing unit.
So our practice is not only to get at the gap between feeling and craving.
Yeah,
it's really to get at the five past or five present causes.
Yeah, it's actually the five causes in the present. And I wanted to sort of finish this by taking the cessation side of the 12 factors. So your question just leads into the side that I was going to deal with. Because then as the sutta goes on, we have the, I'm still on page 356, and we have the exposition of cessation with the remainderless fading away and cessation of ignorance comes cessation of formations or volitional activities. With the cessation of volitional activities, cessation of consciousness, and so on, down to with the cessation of existence, cessation of birth, with the cessation of birth, aging and death, sorrow, limitation, pain, grief, and despair cease. So that such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. So again, here we have the process of cessation laid out in terms of this 12-fold series. But when we look at this in practical terms, we have to ask, where does the process of cessation actually take place? And if we take the fundamental process of the causes, the causation, going from using the 20 modes of the four groups, then of course we can't actually deal with past causes, because they took place in the past, and the present effects are present with us now. But what we have to deal with are what are called the five present causes. And the most fundamental of the causes is ignorance, avijja or avijja. And so what is needed to counteract ignorance is vijja, that's wisdom or knowledge or panya. Jnana, panya, vijja, knowledge, wisdom, understanding, insight, and so on. And so at the most basic level, the whole series of causation comes to an end with the arising of ignorance or, with the arising of wisdom or insight. But sort of the temporary measure to prevent the round from getting fueled again, what one has to do is to, you know, in a practical day-to-day life, to create a kind of space for wisdom to arise, for insight to arise, is to weaken the connection between the feelings and craving. So if we surrender to the craving, then we become engaged in a new round of activities, which will create new seeds of karma. But when we exercise that, this is restraint of the senses, so instead of letting the senses dominate us, then we can restrain the mental activity that arises in response to sensory input. Then on the basis of that gap created between sensory input and the arising of craving, we can develop mindfulness and clear comprehension of experience. And then through the development of mindfulness and clear comprehension, there will come panya, wisdom, until that wisdom blossoms into full knowledge, deep understanding, penetrative realization. And then with that, the round comes to an end. Then what is actually eliminated in the present is ignorance, craving, clinging, and when that's fully eliminated, then there's no more volitional activity. There's actually volitional activity, but it doesn't create karma anymore. And so then there comes the end of birth, old age, sickness, and death. Okay, and that's the cessation side.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing, because we're given these senses, right? So we have these senses, and so we you mentioned restraining the senses, because we don't want to like craving, even just drinking or being with a girlfriend. Yeah. But then when I walk around the woods, you know, and the trees and the beauty, and I love the hike, and I love lakes and streams. You know, it's a very funny, fine line.
Yeah, this is, I think, what has to be understand how this actually works in practice. And also, you have to remember that the Buddhist training is a gradual training. So he doesn't say that everybody has to give up their girlfriends, husbands have to give up their wives give up their husbands. But okay.
I don't know if I understand, but, you know, to some degree, you don't want to cling on to these things.
Yeah.
Grasping, but it's like an oxymoron. It's a conflict because we have these wonderful senses of things that we feel a flower, we can smell a flower, and there's some craving there, just almost inherent in the nature of ourselves. So.
So what?
I'm giving up drinking. I'm giving up eating meat. You know, all this stuff. But then I walk around and I get this almost euphoria from being in nature.
Yeah, I do too.
Okay. So,
I mean, I live right across from this Seven Jewels Lake, so I see it every, you know, every day.
Right. So there you go, and you're in a better state than I am, hopefully, towards enlightenment. But the senses. The restraint from senses, we can't restrain from them.
I would make a distinction here between what I would call the wholesome use of the senses, so that I would say that exposure to nature can be mentally uplifting and inspiring and even purifying. And so, like, in the autumn or spring, if I walk around this lake, when I come back, I feel the mind is very much settled, calm, tranquil, uplifted with a kind of joy and delight.
And this is true, but yet it leads to a certain type of clinging. Another example is I spent some time with my daughter this summer, and then she moved out to California and went out with her. And it's pure love, but afterwards, this, after you're exposed to something, whether it's nature, whether it's my daughter's love, there's a missing, there's a clinging, there's a craving, there's an emptiness. And it's just a funny thing. It's just almost a philosophical conversation of the inherent nature of ourselves, and that we're instinctually, I feel attachment to my daughter. It's just a very interesting thing. I think about this as you're talking about this whole time. These pure things of love or nature, that, and I agree with it, there's a certain, but that fine line of the euphoria that we get because I was with my daughter, but now I cling and I miss her.
Yeah, I think that's quite human and quite natural, and I don't think one should fight against those feelings of love. One should try, of course, to reduce the attachment somewhat by considering, there are different ways to go about this. One is to consider that in the course of this beginningless round of birth and death, it's hard to find a single person who has not been at some past time our own son, our own daughter, our own mother, father. And so by reflecting in this way, one could extend that feeling of love, ideally, I say, to all sentient beings, or at least to all human beings. But again, one shouldn't blame oneself if one feels a certain preference for a select number of human beings rather than others, since it's just natural to feel in that way. Maybe to somebody with children who would have any comment on this? Okay, Tracy does.
One thing I found having a child is that it can be a way to work with impermanence. My daughter, who I love very much, is preparing to go away to England to go to school.
So even as I naturally, I love her and I like to be with her, I have to reflect on the impermanence of life. So it, in a way, it can be a way to work in life, in a practical way.
Well, I understand all these things, and I study Buddhism, and I just, the impermanence, and I meditate on these things, and just. I almost find that my point is that the human condition and our feelings is almost an obstacle to enlightenment of sorts. It's just a very interesting conundrum as we are as humans. We're very human based, and that's why our practice is so hard to get beyond that.
Andrea, you want to say?
I'll wait for the microphone.
Thank you.
Just for you.
It's for the recording. You don't know why.
I'm teasing.
What you had mentioned earlier when you were talking about how to practice restraint, that was the first part of your question, yes?
Yeah, that was about to say restraint in the senses. If you mentioned that word.
Right. Well, in everyday walking life, that's kind of hard to do.
But when they speak about, I'm trying to put this in an articulate manner, when the Buddha talks about sitting ardent, resolute, restrained from sensual pleasures in the meditation, because in a meditation, you can do that, at least for that temporary period of time. Temporary, okay. While you're doing that, you are secluded, you are restrained, you are renunciating in that space of time. You might go out and, you know, drink a bunch of liquor afterwards, but in that space of time, that's where you can really start to look at that. And if you can, that temporary moral state, calm state, restrained state is what helps you, brings you to the mindfulness or the samadhi. Even though, like, and it's true, and then hopefully you can look at how these things connect, and look at the feelings, and look at how things, like, grasp. But then it's quite another thing, I know, to do that.
Maybe if just one other person has a comment, then we'll take one more comment, and then we'll have to stop for the morning.
I have an observation about the cessation phase of the 12 path, because it looks like it leads us back to the Noble Eightfold Path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, of course, the Noble Eightfold Path is the way to bring about the arising of this of wisdom, of the insight.
Because, you know, as you mentioned, the most fundamental is ignorance, the way to counteract is wisdom or insight, which is really brought about by meditation,
yeah,
concentration, and then the basis to that is, so kind of part of that.
Okay, we'll have to stop now for the morning.
Can I just do something very quickly?
Yeah, okay.
But I need a translator. I want to say it in Chinese because I don't know how to express it.
You're always very good, translator.
Oh, good. Anyway, I just say it in Chinese and say somebody can help to translate.
Yeah, you're wrong, can translate.
先生刚刚说的，比如喜欢自然啊那种哈，我是觉得那些，它是也就是一种 nature， 那种东西。然后就是说，我们不去执着于那个东西，我们当时可能是enjoy， but after that， 我们可以放下，就是说不去，老是想着哦，我今天必须要去那个地方，我心里面才会舒服啊，那样就是说不去执着。就我之前有听故事，就是说阿罗汉，我忘记是哪个阿罗汉，就是佛的大弟子之一。我听到那个歌声的时候还会起舞，就是他有一种习性在。但是他不会说，去执着那个东西，怎么样？好，谢谢。
Oh, she's just saying that, enjoy nature and don't attach to it. She also enjoys nature, but after you have the enjoyment, after that moment of enjoyment, you just don't attach it. Don't keep thinking back and then say that I want to get back to it. And she said she gave an example of an arhan. I don't think it's an arhan, but well, I'll just translate what she said.
Yeah.
Arhan, who after hearing music, pleasant music, will start dancing. But that arhan didn't have an attachment to it. So that's the example she gave.
I don't know any examples in the Pali text.
But it's from the Mahayana.
I know that it's from the Dajin Lak. Yeah. I know. But what that one does find in the Theragata and Therigata is that some of the arhans who lived in the woods, they would write poems extolling the beauties of the mountains, the clouds over the mountains, the birds and monkeys playing in the forest. So, don't be worried about enjoying nature. Okay, so we end for this morning. And today I have to give a class in the afternoon for the retreat, so I won't have the discussion group. I want to take a little rest after the lunch. But any further questions, we'll finish the sutta next week. We'll have the class next week back in the Taishu, Guanyin Hall. I think back in Guanyin Hall. There's nothing going on next week, is there? Yeah. Okay, so we're back in Guanyin Hall next week. And then any questions that you have on anything discussed today, we can discuss next week. Okay, so I'll end with the sharing of the merits. But you have the... okay, go for some. Okay, so we share the merits with the devas, the deities, the nagas, the buddhas, and all beings, wishing them to be well and happy, and to protect the Buddha's teaching, to protect ourselves and others. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodipa shiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodipa shiram rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu mamparam etavata chamehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata chamehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata chamehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavagupadaya vichyekato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha asanya sanino dukkha pamochantu pasantu nibhutin. Okay, we could end with the three bows.
Out of bondage.